Welcome to Recalculating America, a program dedicated to small business in America. Recalculating will help you, the American small business owner, build a new business or help you to grow your existing one. Each week, experts will give you useful information about starting your new business, and you will hear from professionals selected to help you grow your business. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest and has many years of experience helping small businesses build and grow their businesses. Now he is sharing his ideas with you over the air. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money. He specializes in helping small business owners make their money work as hard as they do. Now, your host, Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins.
Good evening. I'm Dan Perkins, and I'm your co-host along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating, a program dedicated to helping small business leaders grow their business. We draw our name from the best-selling book, which features contributions of more than 100 presidents, experts, and leaders, all of whom offer ways to grow your small business. Don?
Dan, as you know, everyone's concerned about security, online security, physical security, et cetera. But it's becoming especially difficult in these days. We've got a really special guest today to talk about it. So why don't you welcome her to the show?
Thanks. Today we have Mitzi L. Hill, who is a partner of Taylor English, and is it Duma? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, in Atlanta, Georgia, where she works on evolving technology issues, largely with a focus on new technologies affecting consumers, commercial intelligence, property strategies, and compliance. Mitzi, thank you for joining us today. And before we get into the weeds, tell us a little bit about yourself and about your firm.
Well, good morning, Don and Dan. I'm delighted to be here with you and appreciate this opportunity to talk with your audience. My background is that I am 20-plus years, I won't say how many plus from 20, but in practice as a lawyer in Atlanta, handling technology-related issues as technology has become an increasingly important part of all our lives, both at home and at work. And a lot of what I focus on is compliance related to information security and privacy of personal information, particularly since much of that information is now moving to a technology-driven environment or an online environment. And here at Taylor English, I work with a lot of small and medium-sized clients on what kind of information they have, how best to plan for its security, and to plan for what happens if they ever have a security incident, and I help respond if they do have a security incident. Our firm is about 12 years old. We're located in Atlanta, and we help large and small companies across the Southeast and all over the United States.
Well, thank you for that. How would people get in touch with you and your firm?
My direct email is mhill@taylorenglish.com. That's T-A-Y-L-O-R. And the main number for the firm is 770-434-6868.
And does the firm have a website?
It does. We are at taylorenglish.com.
Super. We'll put that on our website tonight after the show so that they didn't have a chance to write it down, at least to get to you.
Great. I'd love to hear from them.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Anybody who can help our listeners. I guess I want to start off with what I thought was a question about what I thought was the most terrifying might be too strong a word, but maybe not. The testimony of the director of the FBI, James Comey, before Congress a week or so ago, when he said there is no sense, there is no reality to security, that mm-hmm. we really can't secure communications.
Right.
Were you surprised at his, and that's a paraphrase, but were you surprised at what he was inferring?
I'm never surprised to hear that kind of a sentiment expressed, even maybe especially from the experts. The running sort of dark joke or commentary, depending on your perspective, I guess, about most companies who have an online presence, which really is everybody today because we all have a computer network, is that there are two kinds of companies, those who've been penetrated and those who've been penetrated but don't yet know it.
Yeah. Betsy, do you think what he was saying, and I'm not trying to be facetious in my question, I'm not trying to ask an expert here. Do you think that there was a broader implication to his comment that not only business, but we as individuals don't really have safe communication, and the idea that we think we can is probably bogus?
I think that's probably right, because I think there is very little distinction between how businesses communicate and how individuals communicate. Individuals may prefer a certain universe of devices. Those may be more often less secured or less there may be less effort put into securing them than there is for business devices and business networks. But all of us use electronic communications all day long. We text, we send email, we surf around on the internet, we send in information in order to get services or to request promotional materials or to apply for loans or scholarships or jobs or whatever it is. And sometimes we're sending sensitive information when we use those forms of communication, and sometimes we're just sending, you know, yes, I prefer this brand of peanut butter, please send me a coupon. So,
well, you know, it's interesting. I was thinking about Mr. Comey and what he was talking about security, and I'm an author, and I've written 3 books on radical Islamic nuclear terrorism against the United States, and my readers chastised me for leaving everybody hung at the end of the 3rd book, so they required me to write another book, and I wrote a sequel, which will be out in a few months. But in that particular sequel is a discussion about hacking and infiltration into, in this case, business data. But I'm fascinated, and maybe you have some insight here. I'm fascinated that we are using, that's a broad statement, some people in this space are using the words that represented 1950s or 60s technology to represent today. For example, the New York Times did an article literally the day of Trump's inauguration, and they had the inauguration photo above the fold, and the sister article was on hacking, and they used the terminology wiretap.
Right.
And I find it amazing that we're continuing to use this word wiretap when that specific technology died long ago, but we still tend to refer to it. Why do you think that is?
I think a lot of that is inertia. Many of us have power windows in our cars, but if we want someone next to us at a stoplight to roll down their car window, we still make the motion of cranking the old manual handle. And I think
that's a wonderful analogy.
Or maybe it just shows my age. I told you I wouldn't tell you how many years past 20 I'd been in practice.
Mm-hmm.
But I
well, join the crowd.
Yeah, I think all of us, you know, get used to a certain paradigm or get used to the world being a certain way, and that's how we respond to it. It is interesting to see ourselves and the rest of the world sort of struggling to come up with new ways to describe these kinds of intrusions that make sense to people, that convey what is accurately happening from a technological perspective and a political perspective and a social perspective. You're right, wiretapping doesn't really exist anymore. That sounds very Cold War. But the other interesting thing is that for most businesses, the efforts that you take to prevent outsiders from getting access to whatever it is you're trying to protect inside your company often ignore the fact that for many businesses, really the more likely problem they will face is an insider issue, not a hack from the outside. It's the rogue employee or the careless employee who causes more problems, I think, in day-to-day operations than any large-scale nefarious kind of outside forces do.
That's a great transition to the next question that I wanted to ask you.
Excellent.
Don and I started this program because we were doing another show on political commentary and current events, and felt that with the election being over, that people's interest was going to change. When, in fact, Mr. Trump became the nominee and then won the presidency, we both concluded that there's going to be an opportunity, and perhaps even an exploding opportunity, for people to start new small businesses that who were reluctant for a myriad of reasons under the Obama years. And so my question to you, which I think is, I'm asking only the good questions, but I think an important question for our audience. We know that there are a lot of people who are contemplating starting up their own small business because of the momentum that Mr. Trump has created in his desire to want to make America great again. What I want to ask you is, with that background, for somebody who is thinking about starting their own business, what should they be concerned about in terms of security, and what are some of the basic things you think they need to do?
Well, I think that's a great question for businesses of all sizes, and I think it's particularly good for smaller businesses because they may not present the target to the world that a large company does, but the consequences of having a problem are probably greater for a small business. An information leak or a PR debacle based on losing customer credit cards, for example, has a much bigger potential impact for a small business or a startup than it does for a large global retailer who has resources to address it and plenty of other ways to offset the impact, both from a PR and a legal, well, and a financial perspective. And so the thing I would encourage people to think about, and this applies both to physical information, so hard copies, printouts, things that are, you know, sitting on your desk or in your filing cabinet, but also to your electronic networks. The first is to understand what kind of information you have and whether any of it, it should be secured either from a legal perspective or from just a good common sense practices kind of perspective. And that would be things like employee social security numbers or their payroll information or their health care plan information, credit card numbers belonging to your customers, you know, proprietary information that you as a company may view as your trade secret. You generally have a duty to keep that secret if you want to enjoy the protection that goes along with legal status as a trade secret. So those would be some examples of things that you probably want to plan affirmatively for protecting and to understand that you have. You probably want to know who has access to that and why. You can consider whether everyone in the organization should have access to all of that information, whether it should be encrypted when it's stored or transmitted by your organization, whether certain people should have access to certain things. For example, if someone handles all of the payroll information, they probably need access to your whatever your HR materials are, but maybe not everybody in your organization needs to have access to that. So first, understanding what you've got and who has access to it. The second would be take measures to secure it. Lock the filing cabinet. Ask people to clean their desks up. Make sure that their computers are password protected. You know, make sure your computer network is up to date, both from a hardware and software standpoint, that you have firewalls and virus protection and that you update those regularly. Any good network consultant can help you figure out how to put the best kind of perimeter around your business, for lack of a better analogy. So first, you know, understand your information. Second, secure it. And three, plan for what happens if you ever do have a problem. Who would you call? Do you have a lawyer that can handle those things? Do you need a PR agency that can handle those things? you know, is there somebody internally who you would tap to speak for the company? Those kinds of things. Who would shut down any kind of a leak? How would your business continue its operations if your email were disabled, for example? Planning ahead for some of those things doesn't have to be terribly complicated, but having some assignments about who you would call and what their job would be if you really had an emergency, and making sure those people know it and that you revisit that periodically, is a really important measure for a lot of reasons. One is, going through that exercise can help you identify gaps in whatever your security is, so you may be able to close a gap and forestall a problem. Second is that it will help you react and shut down a problem more quickly, which can mean that you contain the size of the problem when you do have one. And the third is that if you ever are faced with a problem, now you have a good story to tell. If your customers complain to you or if a regulator has questions about why you did things the way you did. And I think that's important in terms of minimizing your exposure. And then the fourth thing, I'm sorry, please go ahead.
No, you're doing great, Mitzi. Keep going.
This is my last point. The fourth thing I was going to say is consider carrying a cyber insurance policy in addition to your general commercial policies and any kind of professional liability policies that you have. A cyber policy fills in a lot of gaps. It can cover you for direct losses. Say somebody hijacks your network and you are not operational for a week. Those kinds of lost opportunity costs can be covered. Or if you have to buy all new servers, or if you have to hire a PR firm or a law firm, or send out a bunch of customer notices because credit card numbers got out. Those kinds of things can be covered by the right kind of cyber insurance, and it is relatively inexpensive to carry.
Don.
Mitzi, that's fantastic. At the end of your time here, we'd like you to summarize them. But let me ask you, is a small business liable for if any or all breaches involving their confidential information, like credit card numbers, and how do you protect against it?
Well, the question of liability, it's a very good question, and it's a little bit up in the air right now. We don't have a whole lot of standards, legal standards, for most kinds of businesses in the states that say, one, here's the kind of information you have to protect. Two, here's how you have to protect it. And three, here's what you face if you don't. We do have a patchwork of laws that say certain kinds of information, if it gets out, you have to notify the affected individuals and maybe help them make sure that they're not the victims of identity theft. But we don't have a whole lot of standards that say, here is who is liable. And so what you're seeing is that as these issues become more important, there are a lot more lawsuits dedicated to trying to figure out who is liable. And the best example I can give you of the uncertainty here is the Target credit card breach that happened 4 years ago. Target was sued by a class of consumers and settled with them for about $10 million. In relatively short order. So all the shoppers whose credit cards got out, that went away pretty quickly. Target has since then been fighting with the banks that issue those credit cards and the issuing organizations, so the MasterCards of the world, over whether it is Target's fault that those credit card numbers got out and whether they should have to pay for it or whether the banks should have to pay for that. And most of those claims seem to be settling, but those are in the multiple millions of dollars, much more than the consumers got in their settlements. So we don't have any really clear standards to say, yes, you are liable if your information gets out. But I think it's prudent to behave as though you would be liable and to have because we now, I think no organization now, no company, no matter what size, could credibly go into a courtroom kind of situation and say, I had no idea this might happen to me. We've seen too many examples of large and small organizations suffering some kind of data incident for anybody to be able to say, I just really didn't know that I ought to plan for that. And so I think you should design your business, if you're starting one, with the idea that you do have some duty to take care of the information that's in your custody and plan to do so.
Can I follow that with another question, Don?
Of course.
I don't have any hard evidence. I'm a registered investment advisor, and I manage money. I've been doing it for 43 years, and I do my own analysis on companies. And I have to say that when you use the example of Target or other major breaches with the major banks or Yahoo or whoever, I don't see any significant backlash in terms of customers canceling their accounts. It's almost as if we have accepted the reality that there's going to be a breach. And yes, some of them do sue, but given the size of the Target breach, $10 million doesn't seem like a lot of money. So have we become complacent, or are we convinced there's nothing we can do about it?
I think that's a really good question. Are we complacent, or are we just resigned? And it may be a little bit of both. I also think that fortunately, the high-profile consumer-level breaches that you've read about, like Target, have not, by and large, produced a wave of credit card fraud, identity theft, financial damages that have actually hit consumers in the pocketbook. Mm-hmm. Because most of these things have been discovered relatively quickly. They've been announced pretty promptly, which I think is an important part of anybody's planning. And that has enabled consumers to say, cancel my card, monitor my credit, let me get kind of in front of or on top of this problem, this potential problem, before it actually becomes a problem.
But we had the case of Yahoo, which it
right.
happened, and they didn't report it for a year.
No, they didn't. But that didn't involve financial information. And so I think it would be different if Target had been hacked and we hadn't known it for a year, and in the meantime you'd had millions of customers who'd been fighting with their banks about fraudulent credit card charges. I think that might have felt a little different. And if Yahoo had announced more quickly, I think they would have looked a little better, and it might not have affected their purchase price with Verizon so severely. But I don't know whether most consumers look at their webmail address and the things that get sent there and feel especially proprietary about that.
All right. One more question, then I'll turn it back to Don. In one of my books, I wrote about possible terrorist attacks against the United States, and I talked about the possibility of an attack on server farms. And it concerns me that what you were talking about, of all the things that corporations need to do to try, big or small, to try and protect their information, when they put that information and send it over the internet to a server farm, a cloud computing situation, mm-hmm. I believe that there are two dangers that the corporation is taking. There's more and more discussion now being talked about an attack might be on the electrical grid so that the power would fail. And in the case of the Microsoft facility in Chicago, which has hundreds of thousands of Blade servers, power failure would mean not that the data would be corrupted, but the heat would actually destroy the Blade servers and the data would be gone. I think there's perhaps even greater vulnerability to putting information on the cloud, no matter how well you secure it in your local office situation. Do you have any thoughts mm-hmm. about that?
I do. I think the cloud is great for a lot of things. I think anything particularly important or sensitive that is stored in the cloud, you should have a vendor who and a contract with that vendor that tells you exactly where it's stored, exactly how it's backed up, and where, how it will be accessible in the event of an emergency. And so, in other words, if you are storing the heart of your business in the cloud, it should be with a reputable vendor that has a backup plan and a secondary set of your data so that you can recover it if that facility goes down for any reason, weather, attack, accident, you know, what have you.
Don.
Well, we're getting close to the end, but this is fascinating, and we'll probably go a little bit over with Mitzi. But as a small business, what are two or three things, Mitzi, you ask a small, you suggest to a small business owner that he or she should do to protect their business?
I think the things I would do in particular as a small business would be, one, not to cheap out on my network setup, so making sure my hardware is capable of running the most current software and protective kinds of mechanisms like antivirus programs. Two, I would train my employees to understand what the company considers confidential and what their responsibilities are. And I would make sure I understand everybody's access to confidential information so that, for example, if an employee leaves me, I know that the account credentials they used to get into the PeopleSoft portal or the Staples web ordering or whatever it is are cut off when they leave the company. And three, I really would spend some time sitting down, knocking out a plan and getting someone to review it with me to say, does this look like a good way to handle an incident if we ever have one, so that I can pull it out and have a roadmap if we ever have an employee walk off with secrets or email all the company's payroll information to herself or, you know, those, or lose a phone that has the company email attached to it, you know, in a taxi cab on vacation, or has their laptop stolen. It doesn't all have to be malicious activity. I think those would be the places where I would start. And then as kind of an additional layer, I would encourage those small business people to talk to their insurance carriers and see whether they carry a cyber line and what kind of coverage is available that meets their needs and isn't too expensive for them.
We've been talking with Mitzi Hill. She's an attorney. Mitzi, tell people how they could reach you, your firm, and any other information you think they should know.
Well, thank you. I'm a partner with Taylor English Duma in Atlanta. We are a firm that was founded to help small and medium-sized businesses with exactly these kinds of commercial issues. Our website is taylorenglish.com, and the phone number at the firm is 770-434-6868.
Well, thank you. It was very, very informative, and we enjoyed it, and we hope to have you back on again. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
And I guess you've got a word from a sponsor. We'll be right back after this message.
Hate your old fax machine? You can now fax through email. Simply write an email, attach the document, and send. Works with all major email providers. Get rid of the noisy and expensive old fax machine and try Biscom's Cloud Fax. Our solutions are great for businesses of all sizes. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial. That's BISCOM.com.
Welcome back to Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful. Now it's time for Money in Motion. Dan Perkins is our resident expert in making the money you earn work as hard as you do. Here is Dan Perkins.
Well, Don, as we talked before the show started, I wrote a piece several months ago when OPEC decided last fall that they were going to consider a production cut about 180,000 barrels a day of crude oil to try and reduce the overflow. And the idea was that by doing so, they would be able to have prices rise. They'd like to have prices close to $60 a barrel. And I wrote that I thought at that particular time that that would be the death spiral to OPEC. And lo and behold, on this morning on CNBC is an article about how America is now think about this, Don, we're exporting over 1 million barrels of crude oil a day out of the United States. We are cutting into the OPEC supply, and now OPEC is talking about continuing the cuts for another 6 months, and we'll discuss this at their April meeting about whether they're going to continue. My guess is that they are. So what's happening is that OPEC is losing market share. The United States is now exporting. And when you export crude oil, Don, guess what? You're not importing crude oil. You're no longer a dependent nation. You are an independent nation. So the idea that we have become energy independent, and it's going to take a long time to happen, the fact that we are net exporters of 1 million barrels a day says that we are independent. That has kept the price of crude oil trading between 48 and 51. It hit 50 this morning, backed off a little. So the implication here is that crude oil prices are probably going to stabilize in the 50 to 55, let's say $48 to $53 a barrel. What that means is to our listeners, the small business people, is that energy prices should be stable for gasoline, for diesel fuel, for fuel oil, for aircraft or farm machinery, so that we're going to have an extended period of time where the price of crude oil is going to be stable. It's not going to go up much. It could fluctuate up and down based on seasonality. But energy for many businesses is a very big important cost of doing business. And so that means it's going to be somewhat stable. The president is very committed to trying to expand small business. There's talk about moving the tax reform issues up front now, especially since healthcare didn't get through. If we get tax reform, and there's a possibility, I don't see how it's possible that we can get it based on the calendar. There are some people thinking we could do tax reform before the May recess. I think that's pie in the sky. Revising the tax code is a huge job. I think if they can do something about the repatriation of money, offering a lower tax rate to bring it in, 12, 15% instead of 35, we'll have almost $3 trillion that will have an opportunity to work its way back home fairly quickly. So I think tax reform is going to be important to small business. And if we move lower the marginal tax rates for both corporations and individuals, bring them down, that'll mean the small business will be able to put more money in their pocket, or they'll be able to spend more money for hiring additional people. So I think the economy, the Fed said yesterday, they thought maybe there would be one or two more price yield increases in this year, so that we could be maybe looking at another half a point total this year. Manageable, easily manageable. So a lot of things are hanging around and beginning to happen. He signed the executive order on the pipeline. He signed the executive order freeing up coal, which is going to put coal miners back to work. A lot of positive things going on for business in general, Tom.
Well, that's good to hear. We'll get back to that at the end of the program. Now, ready for our next interview. I had a fascinating interview recently with Kyle Tenning, which I'd like the audience to listen to.
Welcome to Recalculating America, a program dedicated to small business in America. Recalculating will help you, the American small business owner.
Our next guest, I'm really looking forward to. because he has some information about how work is going that I personally am really looking forward to hearing about. Kyle Tensing, we welcome you to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Kyle, as we do with all our guests, tell us a little bit about yourself personally, before we go into anything else.
Sure. I am the online content editor at careercast.com, and I've been with that organization for about 4.5 years, and just some background on CareerCast. We are a national job news information website, as well as a place for job search information. You can find career listings in a variety of fields and a variety of organizations from all over the country in the CareerCast database job search engine. And I'm based in Southern California and graduate of the University of Arizona.
Well, we also know from a very source that you're a very good father as well. So, you have a new survey, your company does. Tell us a little bit about it and what you found.
Sure. Well, first to give some background information, at CareerCast.com, we put out a series of reports every year called the Jobs Rated Reports. And we have a big one that comes out, will actually be coming out soon. It comes out in mid-April, that ranks 200 different jobs. And we try to touch on a variety of different industries so that we're looking at things like healthcare and tech, as well as labor jobs, you know, things in construction and carpentry, things like that. And so we try to look at a very broad spectrum of the job market just to get a sense of how much money careers are making, what's their growth outlook, and what sort of stress levels they face. And that's actually one of the major reports that we put out as part of our Jobs Rated series. Every January is a report on job stress. And that looks at the top 10 most stressful jobs from our Jobs Rated report and the 10 least stressful. Now, we go through a series of 11 factors to determine the stress levels. Those range from things like if your own life is at danger or if you're directly responsible for the life of another person, what sort of deadlines you face, how often are you traveling, those sort of things. And you can go over the entire list of all 11 at careercast.com. It's spelled out as part of our stress reports methodology. Well, this report gets quite a bit of feedback every year because people feel like, you know, especially if they make the lowest stress jobs, they usually say, well, hold on a second, my job is pretty stressful. And that's the thing, all jobs face some level of stress. So as we started to receive feedback on this report, that was one of the things we wanted to do, was really kind of reach out and find out what our readers had to say about their own stress levels. So for the last 2 years now, as part of our Jobs Rated report on job stress, we've included a reader survey online to determine who's stressed, how stressed they are, things like that. And we've seen a lot of great response on this survey. As I mentioned, this is the second time that we've done it. Last year, we got about 850 respondents. This year, over 1,000 responded. So quite a bit of interest there. And what we found was that people find themselves to be very stressed on the job. Of our roughly 1,100 respondents, nearly 82% said that they face on a stress level from a 7 to 10 on a 10-point scale. So you're talking about people feeling really, really bogged down at work, and for a variety of different reasons.
Keep going. You're on a roll. Tell us more.
Sure. Yeah, so as far as that 82% of people who score themselves as highly stressful, nearly a quarter of all respondents scored an 8. So that was the most popular response. 7 got about 23%. Now, not many people scored themselves a 10 out of 10, and that's probably fortunate. I feel like if you're facing 10 out of 10 on the stress scale, you might be at risk for some health issues. And that's something that's important to keep in mind with job stress, is stress does play a part in our health. So if you do feel stressed at work, certainly do your best to mitigate that. But as far as industries that we heard from, we heard quite a bit from people in healthcare. That was our number one responding industry, and you can certainly understand why healthcare would be facing a lot of stress when you're talking about the well-being of other people essentially being in your hands as part of your job. Not only that, but the hours can be very long depending on the kind of healthcare that you work in. Now, something that's sort of ironic on that front is our number one least stressful job in our 2017 Job Stress Jobs Rated Report was actually tied into the healthcare field, and that was diagnostic medical sonographer. Now, the reason for that is you're talking about a career that typically you work usually like in office hours, kind of, and you're in a setting that's not like the ER typically. Now, there are some sonographers who will work in that ER kind of setting, and certainly that does change the variables that would cause a job stress, without a doubt. But then as far as some of the other industries that we heard quite a bit from, education was one that we received quite a bit of response from. And that's one that I find interesting in terms of stress levels, because so much of that is sort of out of the employee's hand, whether you're a professor or an elementary school teacher. The kind of stress that you're going to face is, it can be up to your students, how they're responding. It can be up to, if the curriculum changes in your district. Even federal guidelines can contribute to stress there if you're talking about having to meet standards for, like, say, for example, federal testing, standardized testing. So that's one of the most interesting from this takeaways that I have from this survey was the level of stress that people in education cite as part of their job.
Could I interrupt you and ask, in your survey, is it possible that it's almost a self-selecting survey, that people with high stress would answer a question like that rather than people who have less stress? And kind of skew the results?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. And that's part of the reason that this isn't part of our jobs rated report, which for that we really take a, as I mentioned, like the methodology, we take a very scientific, analytic approach with that. This being an online survey, obviously we can't control some of the variables, like who's responding. It's not necessarily a direct snapshot of the overall workforce based on the percentages of people that we're hearing from. For example, if we're not hearing a lot from people in service industries, and that makes up a huge portion of the job market, so obviously that factors in. And as you mentioned, people are more likely, I feel, to respond to a survey like this when they are feeling stressed than if they aren't. It's sort of like, if you think of the comment section on an article, typically the people who are going to be responding are the ones who disagree rather than those who agree, because, if you feel positive about the product, most of the times people aren't going to go out of their way to say that. And I feel like this is the same for an online survey. You're not necessarily going to see the people who feel like they're not stressed with their jobs responding. And I do feel like that can contribute to the 82% scoring on the high end here.
Very, very true. Your website again, where people can see the survey and other information?
Yeah, that's at careercast.com. We have new information going up all the time. We usually have about 2 jobs rated reports coming out per month. As I mentioned, in mid-April, our big report for the year comes out. And that's always gets a lot of discussion going, very exciting. So be sure to check that out, as well as our daily information. We have career advice, career news, and trends going up on our website all the time. And if you're a job seeker, we have a database full of jobs through a wide variety of industries. And if you're looking for niche jobs like, in, say, information technology, we have specifically tailored sites such as it.careercast.com, and you can reach those portals by going to the main careercast.com homepage.
Will you spell out the website? We're on radio.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, my apologies. That's careercast.com.
Well, the one last question I'd like to ask you is, how do you see the future? Do you see some jobs having greater demand than others?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like the trend that we've seen over the last decade or so is certainly in information technology-based economy, you know, and that certainly stands to reason when you think of how reliant we are day-to-day on tech information. If you own, like, let's say you own your own local farm, you know, and you sell strawberries to the local grocery stores, you know, it used to be that there was a time where you just drove your truck over to the grocery store and sold your strawberries, but now you can reach an entirely global market, you know, assuming that you have the infrastructure to ship those strawberries, you can reach consumers now online. So even something like a small mom-and-pop farm shop needs IT professionals, whether it's contractors or somebody who works with them full-time. So as we move more and more to that sort of landscape, IT is going to obviously continue to be a booming sector, and healthcare as well, in part because of the baby boomer generation is getting older and needs more healthcare assistance. And interestingly enough, IT and healthcare were both industries that saw job growth during the Great Recession, and that's only accelerated since we've come out of the recession. So those are really kind of the two backbone industries right now in the economy, and I believe will be continue to be the direction that we move in for the next 10 years or so.
What about the so-called gig economy? Are you seeing inroads into that, where people are being hired for projects or specific lengths of time?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as I was talking about the Jobs Radar reports, our most recent one, interestingly enough, was about freelance careers. And that's something that has seen some substantial growth. From 2004 to 2014, people who identified in their tax returns as independent contractors grew from 12% of the economy to 18%. So you're seeing growth there of about one-third. And obviously with the growth of IT, that's a big contributing factor to the growth of the gig economy. If you're somebody who, you know, using the analogy once again of the small farm, if they need website support, they aren't necessarily going to need a full-time staffer. So you can find work that way. If companies just need to contract out for, you know, say 1 month terms for a particular project, that's a great way to pick up some extra money. Now, it is certainly a risk-reward sort of endeavor, because if you work independently, you're not going to have company-provided health care. So that's one of the challenges there that comes up with working in a gig economy, as well as knowing if your skill set is going to be in demand enough to get regular work. Because if you have huge gaps, that's obviously going to be very difficult, you know, to bring in income if you're not able to find jobs over, you know, weeks and months.
Well, have you also noticed, I mean, we're into a new administration. Has the number of jobs, openings increased with your company? Are you seeing any trends in that area?
It's a little early to tell any sort of specific trends in terms of change in presidential administration or federal government practices. You know, until a budget's passed and that kind of thing. And typically with a presidential administration, you don't really start to see policy impact hiring until, you know, at the very earliest, maybe 9 months in or so, because you do need that time to for policy to begin and take effect. And the most recent Department of Labor numbers for February 2017 in terms of the number of new hires was around 200,000, which is holding pretty steady for the month-to-month growth that's been the case since about 2013. So for about the last 4 years or so, 3 years or so, I would say, closer to that, it's been pretty consistent in that growth range from about 100,000 to 200,000. So there's been no real change yet.
One other question. Have you seen any trends in terms of we hear figures that say that most jobs are created by small businesses, but do you see anything in your numbers to back this up, or any of data?
Unfortunately, that's a tad outside of my area of expertise, just because that's not something that we focus on at CareerCast specifically. Now, that is a great idea for a potential future jobs ready report, however. That might be one that we have to study a little more closely.
If you do that survey, we'd be very interested in it because people, you know, say small business are the engine of job growth, but no one's ever, in my view, really done a survey to prove that point.
Yeah, I feel like that's you hear that mentioned sort of anecdotally, but yeah, absolutely, being able to pull up the hard numbers on that, I feel like would be important to back that up.
Well, we both got our work cut out for us then, don't we, Kyle?
absolutely.
We're talking with Kyle Tenzing. He's the editor of Career Jobs. He's been talking about his survey on stress and been giving us some really terrific information. And Kyle, any last thoughts you'd like to share with our audience about the survey and about things in general that you've run across?
Sure, yeah. You know, as far as our survey goes, as I kind of alluded to earlier, if you feel really stressed at your workplace, interestingly enough, we found in that survey a high correlation in terms of the number of people who say they wish they could leave their job and the number of people who received at least a bachelor's degree to get into their career. So I think what that's saying is that people feel like they're tied into a job where maybe they feel stressed out or unsatisfied because they spent the money to go to college and get a degree and follow a very specific path. And given how much student loan debt there is in our country, I feel like that's a very justified fear that people might have. You know, if you spend all this time to go to college to get your bachelor's degree, and if you go on and get a doctorate or a master's, you know, that's even more money and more time that you've invested. It's not too late to change your career path, and there's alternative methods now of obtaining training for certain jobs. You know, whether it is going back to your local community college, you know, on your weekends or that sort of thing, you shouldn't let that be the number one thing that keeps you from switching careers if you feel like you're not in the right job for you. And that's one of the things at CareerCast.com, we have some information and advice on making a switch in careers if you are, you know, bound to a specific industry because of your degree, or if you're looking to get started in something new and aren't really sure, you know, what first steps you need to take. I recommend checking out CareerCast.com. We have some advice to that end, and certainly don't let that be the thing that keeps you from making a career switch.
You know, that's ironic because in the most recent Bones episode of the TV series, one of the main characters is encouraged by Bones, one of the co-stars, to reconsider his career. And I found that here was a person that was going for his doctorate, and she was saying to him, you don't have the passion for it. Go and do something else. It was such a switch that it kind of stopped the show, and I thought it was very interesting. And you're absolutely right. During the sit-in down in Lower Manhattan a couple of years ago, a woman raised a sign and said she had spent $180,000 to learn the women's studies, and she couldn't find a job. And someone said to her, "Why don't you get another specialty?" You're so right about this. It's so unexpected from you, Kyle, but it's so true. You're very accurate.
Well, I certainly like to think so. And at least on this front, too, you know, if you don't have a passion for a particular career, I think if you think of the amount of time that you spend on the job, you know, the average person, if you're working a 40-hour job, chances are you're working more than 40 hours. And then you also add things like travel time to commute to and from. You know, you're talking about a huge portion of your life is spent in a job. If you don't feel passion for it and if you don't feel satisfied by it, there's no reason that you shouldn't try to branch out and try something new. And kind of going back to that gig economy thing, the growth of that I feel like is an interesting avenue for people to kind of test the waters you know, if you use some of your downtime to maybe work in a field that's always fascinated you, find out if it really is the right fit without maybe necessarily jumping full in and finding out that you're not suited for it.
You're so accurate. Kyle, you've got to come back after April and tell us more about your other surveys, because you certainly gave us a lot to think about today.
Oh, it would be my pleasure.
Welcome. We've been talking with Kyle Tenzing. He's editor of Career Jobs. I'm getting it correct.
Career Cast.
Am I not, Kyle?
It's a Career Cast.
Say it again.
Career Cast. Cast, C-A-T.
Please keep that in mind, ladies and gentlemen. Go to his website, and we certainly hope to see him again here on the program. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was wonderful, Kyle. You're a terrific guest. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, no, thank you.
You, now, can you hear me, Dan?
Yes, sir, I can.
What did you think of what he said? I found it, Kyle's interview one of the more fascinating ones, particularly about stress and about leaving their job. You've been dealing with the executives for a long time. What are your thoughts?
I think that the last 8 years that we've gone through as a group of people working, whether we're leading or following, has been perhaps some of the most stressful times in the history of our country. I know, for example, on in September of 2008, when the Congress decided to not pass a bailout and the markets collapsed, in 43 years of managing money, I really felt that we were on the brink of a major collapse in the global economy and headed for another major depression. But Congress got their act together and changed. So I think the tepid growth in the economy, I think the biggest single factor, Don, is that for the average household, they haven't had a raise in their income level in probably 10, 12 years. Even with modest inflation, that's a diminishment in the standard of living. And so I think stress has been a problem for our country for a long time. And depending upon who you believe, a generation can be between 15 and 20 years. We're coming up on at least 10 years of virtually no growth. We almost have a generation who's never experienced any growth. I'm hopeful that Mr. Trump and his enthusiasm and his desire to bring about change will, in fact, help relieve some of the stress, because people will start getting better jobs and more money.
Well, what do you think about his comment about the gig economy? That's something that's really starting to grow amongst especially smaller businesses, ironically.
Well, when you think about it, you can hire a person with a specific talent or ability for a specific project. You don't have to put them on the payroll as an employee, so that saves additional taxes that you don't have to pay. You don't have to pay for health care. That's an important way as you're trying to figure out if your business is going to grow, rather than put on an employee and take on that burden. A gig is a great way.
Well, do you also think that dreaded word Obamacare and its 50 employee mandates, once you hit 50 employees, you get all sorts of mandates, is also holding up things and making it difficult?
Well, I'd like to answer that question, but we're out of time, and maybe we can pick that up on our next show. But yes, I do think it does. Has had a significant impact. So this is Dan Perkins.
Well, And this is Don Mazzella, who's had a really fascinating time today, listening to two very interesting guests. And hope you'll be back with us next week.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's show was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, for past shows and special offers. And until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success.
We needed to go over.
Yes, because